We were raised again only 5 years ago, which is why, she waved around with a look of slight embarrassment, we're still only moderately well off, as you can see. I mean, we can't really afford to have children yet, but we have each other and our little farm, and God has been kind to us. Her thick eyelashes emphasized a few quick blinks. Didn't have no truck with religion until I died, said Andrew awkwardly. But that experience kind of concentrates one's mind on spiritual things. And when I found myself buck naked and dripping wet and looking up at a Red Cross chopper, I tell you, I just got down on my knees and praised the Lord. What you might call a born-again Christian, said Mally. The rest of us didn't quite get why Andrew and Abigail laughed so much they had to clutch each other for support. You could say that, Andrew gasped, knuckling his eyes. He took a deep breath and spoke more seriously. But apart from the, relief and thankfulness and so on, when I had time to think about it, I figured, well, if mere man can do that, then you'd be a damned fool to think the Almighty couldn't raise all the dead in his own good time. And I knew that only Jesus could stand between me and his righteous indignation on that day. He grinned at our politely frozen faces. Okay, that's me done my witnessing to you godless communists, and you'll hear no more gospel from me unless you ask for more, and I'll gladly give it. But the good book says not to cast your pearls before... It sure does, Abigail interrupted with apparently unnecessary haste. Now let me get you all another drink. Our 40 minutes or so of enjoying the hospitality of Andrew and Abigail did us all a great deal of good, though at the time it seemed only to give us a little relaxation and a sense of unreality arising from the sudden change from our dangerous descent to this scene of sumptuous comfort. As soon as they'd got past the witnessing, which they apparently regarded as something they had to do, however briefly, to any stranger, they chatted to us easily, mainly about themselves, but even this was a courtesy, as though they didn't want us to feel we were being interrogated. We all knew that the time for that would shortly come. They proudly called themselves dirt farmers. Vegetables grown in real soil were a luxury here, supplied to exclusive restaurants for sophisticates who claimed to be able to tell the difference from the carbon copy, and who could afford the considerably more evident difference in price. I had to give Young an unobtrusive nudge at this point. Variety was their specialty. Andrew explained how much searching of the gene banks he had to do to keep ahead of changing fads. Most of the work on the farm was done by what they called dumb machines, and not by what they called hired help. Another nudge to keep Young quiet. Their questions about the solar system were carefully general. We answered with similar care. They expressed relief that Earth was well populated, respected our assurance that it was prosperous, and only wry regret that it had all gone communist, as they put it, since their demise. I don't think you'd find it anything like what you think of as communist, Mally said. And I'm not part of their society, so maybe you can take my word for it. I'm sure you folks like it just fine, said Abigail soothingly. But for ourselves, we like it here. Every man under his own vine and under his own fig tree and no one to make him afraid, added Andrew. Things must have changed a bit since Jonathan Wilde left, I suggested. Since he left? Oh, I see what you mean. Abigail shook her head. Now that I do call unnatural, having another copy running. Anyway, you're right. Things sure have changed. You know, in the old days, before the abolition, they didn't even give civil rights to robots who were as smart as any human being, if not a darn sight smarter. They had androids and gynoids walking about looking just like people, said Andrew. God only knows if they have souls, but they sure do have minds of their own, and anybody could just own one like it was a brute beast. Before we could respond, our looks of surprise, perhaps even in my case, of shock, having been interpreted by Andrew as sharing his dim view of this unenlightened past state of affairs, there was a distant chime. That'll be the Big Shot's delegation now, said Andrew. He looked down at a panel on the table which hadn't been gray and glowing last time I looked. Landing in a couple of minutes. Best get up to the patio. As we rose to our feet, Abigail said, Just one thing. It was courteous of you ladies to turn on those pretty dresses for visiting us, but I think when you're going to be on television and all, you'd best look like you'd just stepped out of a spaceship and not out of a cab on the way to a dance, if you don't mind my saying so. Oh well, I thought, there'd be other chances to show off. But I felt a slight pang as my layered chiffon, Young's brocade chongsam, Andrea's tiered lace, and Suze's silver velvet sheath melted and flowed back into variants of high-gravity on-duty gear. Andrew grinned as the transformation was completed. There's already a group on the nets that says the whole thing's a fake, got up by the defense companies to drum up business. Don't know if you looking like spacers will make them any less suspicious. Abigail approved of my blue denims and high boots. But you want to put some darker color in that jacket, and maybe a mission patch or two. So when we all marched up the stairs, around the balcony, and out onto the patio, we each had a round blue patch with Earth's starry plow and a picture of the terrible beauty over our hearts. The wide patio was also sunken about 6 feet below ground level, open and brightly lit. Over to the left, above the banking around it, was another flat, illuminated space on which a small helicopter was parked. Above it, a much larger helicopter hovered, silent apart from the whap of the rotor blades. It slowly descended close by the smaller one, beside which it looked like the adult of a strange species standing over its infant. I think it was something clever in the ground plan and not any more advanced technology that kept the downdraft blowing above our heads and not into our faces. The helicopter's side door folded away, and a set of steps folded out. In the moment, before anyone appeared, it occurred to me that I felt as if we, and not they, were waiting to meet the aliens. A man stepped down the ladder with a slow dignity which was only partly due to the care which he had to take with the high heels of his tall boots. His medium height and slim build were further extended by a stovepipe hat and an open frock coat, both black, and a colorful waistcoat over a white shirt with a black bootlace tie. A holstered pistol completed the look, the law west of Pecos to the life. He walked over to the rim of the patio, looked to left and right, found the steps, and made his way down. Close behind him followed another man and two women, with a whole crowd of other people behind them. I just had time to recognize the second man. It was David Reed, who'd supplied the outwarders with bonded labor, including some of ours. Our old enemy. And then the man in the tall hat was shaking my hand. "Hello," he said. "My name's Eon Talgarth. I'm pleased to welcome you to Ship City, of which..." His smile twisted a little. "I'm a somewhat reluctant Chief Justice. And you must be Ellen May Ngwethu, acting captain of this expedition?" "That's right," I said. "Pleased to meet you, neighbor." His voice and accent reminded me oddly of the London Noncos. He'd stabilized his age at about 40, but he was much older than that, possibly older than I was. An eerie thought, which impressed me more than his ridiculous judicial fig. "Yeah, I reckon we're all neighbors now," he said. He turned as if to introduce these new neighbors, but any opportunity for formal introductions had been lost. Everybody on one side was indiscriminately shaking hands with everybody they could find on the other and introducing themselves or introducing somebody else. Talgarth looked momentarily at a loss, even taken aback, before he shrugged and relaxed. Reed, I noticed, was working the little crowd expertly, probably avoiding me for the moment and trying to make a friendly impression on my comrades. Abigail and Andrew, on a sudden inspiration, began handing out drinks, and shortly we were all behaving as if we'd just arrived at a slightly formal party. "Comrade?" someone said in a friendly but slightly diffident voice. I turned, smiling at this unexpected greeting. The girl in front of me had long fair hair that sprouted straight up from her scalp and then fell back in a mane between her shoulder blades. She wore a belted jumpsuit which showed off her muscular but definitely female frame. Almost as tall as me, big blue eyes, wide grin, thin sharp nose. Striking rather than beautiful, but I was inured to beauty. "Ellen?" "Hi." She stuck out her hand and I shook it. "My name's Tamara Hunter," she went on. "Very pleased to meet you."
"Likewise," I said politely. "What's your
part in all this?" She scratched her head. "I put up a bit of a fight to get on this delegation, just so the business folk and the judges didn't have it all to themselves. I'm a union official, actually, in the Intersyndical."
"You negotiate terms for the wage slaves?"
"Exactly," she said, looking pleased. "A dirty job, but someone's got to do it."
"We have these too," I said wryly.
Tamara looked around as if concerned that she might be overheard. "Is it really true," she asked, leaning closer, "that in the solar system you have anarcho-communism?"
I thought over this unfamiliar word. We don't have to sell ourselves, and nobody tells us what to do, so I suppose you could call it that.
Wow, she said, her eyes shining. Just knowing that is possible, that it can work, will make a huge difference here.
I don't know about that, I said, mentally comparing what Abigail and Andrew considered modest prosperity with the conditions that had brought about Earth's social revolution. It's not just a question of ideas in people's heads.
Stop plotting there, Hunter, a man's loud voice said. Time enough for that later.
The man who spoke came up and firmly grasped my hand. He had black hair down to the collar of his sharply cut cotton jacket, dark brown eyes, thick black eyebrows, smoothly tanned skin, and the look of ease and unshakable self-confidence which in our society marked out the old comrades, and in this one, I guessed, correctly as it turned out, the rich. But there was more than that. He was terrifyingly old. Among the oldest people alive, and unlike even his contemporary Wild, he'd lived as the same body, the same man, for over 350 years. Again, unlike Wild, he had both the desire and the capacity for power, and had grown strong and proficient in its use.
Hi, Ellen May, he said.
My name's Dave Reed.
I'm happy to meet you at last. You know, I heard about you back in the old days from, well, he laughed. The Outwaters, I have to say.
Your former clients send their regards, I said, rather more coldly than I had intended, and their assurance of no hard feelings about your departure.
Do they indeed?
He seemed surprised and pleased.
Well, as I say, later for that. This is a great occasion.
I sipped my drink, so everyone keeps telling me. He grinned, unperturbed.
It is a bit of a melee, isn't it? I don't think anyone ever worked out the protocols for contact between socialist and capitalist anarchies. Your comrades in the Carbon Conscience have been telling reporters all about your society. Fascinating stuff.
I'm sure it is, I said, wishing I'd briefed Boris and Jaime on what and what not to say.
Used to be a socialist myself, you know, Reed went on. Gave it up as a bad job.
He grinned at Tamara.
Maybe I should have stuck with it.
Then he looked at me and through me, his face momentarily bleak. With a shake of his head, he smiled again.
Battles long ago, he said.
Speaking of which, Ellen, Dee has something to tell you.
A woman was stepping delicately towards us on stiletto heels. She wore a short dress of black lace over a longer one of white crepe, all wow and flutter. She had black hair, pale skin, green eyes, broad cheekbones, and a warm smile.
Hi, Ellen, she said. I'm Dee. Pleased to meet you.
Hello, I said, trying to keep the ice from my voice.
I'm Dave's partner, she went on. I used to be his mechanical squeeze, a clone with a computer in its skull, just a fucking machine.
I know, I said. Wild told us about you. The gynoid woman shook my left hand. I felt, or perhaps imagined, an electrical tingle in her touch. She smiled up at me with disconcertingly wide, bright eyes and parted lips.
So he made it back, she said quietly. And Meg, too?
Meg, Wild's companion, the artificial woman. Another walking doll, another fucking machine.
Yes, I said. They both made it.
Ellen, Dee said. She caught my hands. My mind works differently from yours. I have access to all the old company records and to the city's nets. I have something to tell you. Many of the people here, as you know, were revived from the Fast Folks' robotized workforce. Your parents were not among them.
They were never among them? I asked. It's not just that they didn't make it in the ship?
We all made it in the ship, Reed said. I made damn sure of that. I didn't leave behind anyone, human or ex-human, alive or dead, who'd been conscripted or volunteered to my company.
I looked down at him and unclenched my teeth and nails.
I'm relieved to hear that, I said. I truly am. I'm happy to know that my 200 years of nightmares about them being enslaved in robot bodies were only bad dreams, even if it does mean I'll never see even their copies again. I stopped and took a deep breath through my nostrils.
I can live with that, Reed, but I can't forget who killed them.
Reed shook his head firmly.
It wasn't me or my company who carried out those raids, he said. It was all the doing of the Outwaters. I just saved what could be saved and gave people a chance of a new life, for which I've received no complaints.
Very well, I said. I grasped his shoulder and smiled at him in a way that made a very satisfying shadow of fear show briefly on his face. Now I know who I'm looking for, and I'll take your word that it isn't you. Reed took a step backwards as I let go of his shoulder. His jacket was creased there, and damp. I automatically wiped my hand on my thigh. The two women looked at me with expressions of indistinguishable compassion. Eon Talgarth, the judge, perhaps drawn to the edge of our little group by the intensity of our conversation, broke an uneasy silence.
If it's justice you want, Ellen, if that's among your reasons for coming all this way, you can find it here.
I shook my head. I'm sorry, I said. I lowered my voice. This is a great occasion, a happy occasion, and I don't want to spoil it.
I indicated the more cheerful fraternization going on around us, hoping that the comrades didn't take it too far. But you should know something about us, about me. I don't seek justice. We don't believe in justice. We have the true knowledge. There is no justice, but there is defense and deterrence and revenge. That's what I want, and I will have them all.
Reed, to my surprise, smiled and stepped forward again. Though shorter than I, he held my gaze as though it was he who was looking down.
I know what you mean, he said. I've been there. If you want to take your revenge on the fast folk, be my guest.
He waved his arm expansively.
I can fly you at a moment's notice to the place where we store their templates. You can revive them, tell them exactly what you're going to do to them and why, and make them die 1,000 deaths before we flood the tanks with blue goo. And then, if you want, you can do it again, and again, and...
Stop. I caught his arm.
Enough.
The vast futility of my deepest and darkest, though not my most secret, motives for coming here made me feel cold and sick and dizzy. My hope against hope of meeting copies of my dead parents had been one, and I was racked by its simultaneous disappointment and relief. My desire for revenge on the entities who were incontestably the closest to the original Outwarders had just been exposed by Reed as equally achingly empty. There would be no point in tormenting, no satisfaction in punishing entities with which I didn't even have enough empathy to take pleasure in their pain, if pain it was. It would be as futile as stamping on a recalcitrant machine. There could only be one deterrence, one defense, one vengeance for me, and that was to send them to the same oblivion as they'd sent my parents and so many others, an eternal death without hope of resurrection. Nothing I said or did now could be allowed to imperil that. I smiled at Reed.
You're right, of course, I said. It's just one of those fantasies, isn't it? When you spell it out, when you have the chance to act it out, you see how tawdry and childish it really is. Well, it's understandable, he said. I know how you must feel. He clasped my forearm. Come on, we'll have reporters buzzing about in a few minutes and you'll have to talk to them. When you've got that out of the way, you can all come and see the city.
Yes, I said. I'm looking forward to that. My knees were shaking. Reed noticed and guided me to a seat beside a patio table.
He twitched his eyebrows at Talgarth and the two women, and they slipped back amongst everybody else, standing and talking.
Reed sat down beside me and uncapped a silver hip flask and passed it to me. I sipped something fiery and passed it back.
It's not the same, Reed admitted regretfully.
I really hope you still know how to make single malt. I had to smile. The man had, despite his reputation for ruthlessness, a disarming ability to put one at one's ease.
You'll have to ask the people in Japan about that, I told him.
Oh, God, he said. He took another sip.
And you really do have a world without money? What do you use instead? Computers?
Yes, I said proudly. We don't do much planning, but for what we do, we use computers. The biggest in the world.
Reed's head rocked back, his laugh bayed at the sky, and he didn't see my bleak moment of remembering just why our most important computers were built of brass and steel and looked like the very locomotives of history, incorruptible analytical engines that nothing could divert or deflect. The year is 2098. Below me, a city drifts past, its old towers of concrete and glass overshadowed by recent nano-built spires and surrounded by the shantytown sprawl that predates and will outlast, the buildings which have grown above it like fungi on a damp, dark soil. Beyond even the shanties, the vivid green of the forest with its gray-brown scars of road. Higher even than the towers and rising still and multiplying, the columns of oily smoke.
The smoke is rising from crashes. Here a tower is burning, upward from the 20th floor where a helicopter is spattered on the side of the building like an insect on a windshield. There traffic is gridlocked by numberless collisions. Elsewhere an airliner has fallen out of the sky and set ablaze acres of wooden shacks. I float in the station's telemetry deck, and the unmanned cargo airship floats above Lagos, its scanning cameras showing me scenes I can do nothing whatsoever about. This was a successful city until half a day ago. The West Africans, decimated again and again by the plagues of the 20th century, are almost immune to the last great plague of the 21st. They have survived the death and have even accommodated the floods of the European refugees which fill the shantytowns and swirl about the towers. They still have oil. They still have computer networks. Here, civilization is still rising, not falling. Until now. The computers are crashing, and with them, everything that depends on them. Traffic control, air traffic control, aircraft controls, industrial processes, stock control, telecommunications, and electricity supply. With predictable prisoner's dilemma rationality, people are looting food from the suddenly dark and warming refrigerators before it spoils, raiding the shops before they're stripped, arming themselves before they're robbed, taking to the roads and heading for the villages before anybody else gets the same idea, and each discovering that everyone else is doing the same. We're in a bad way ourselves, running everything on manual or backup or emergency. Our computer programs have been reduced to gibberish. The viruses have shorted systems, wiped memory cores, crippled machinery. But our basic systems are robust. They've been jerry-built and jury-rigged and worked around so often that nothing short of physical force can disable them. We still have air and food. The people down below are in a worse circumstance. They're paradoxically far more reliant on a network of artificial organization than we are. Lagos's biggest export is financial services, pulling in even more than its dwindling oil. All that is gone now. The people I helplessly watch struggling in the streets are worse off even than they know. There's no help coming from anywhere, because everywhere is in the same plight. With an eerie, awful certainty, I know that a very high percentage of those people are already dead as if they were walking around, as elsewhere in other cities not a few at this moment are, in the elliptical downwind teardrop zones of fallout from burning reactors. The airship crumples into the side of a nano tower, and the picture dies. The door of the helicopter opened again, and reporters swarmed out and began hovering and buzzing about, just as Reed had said. I'd thought he'd spoken figuratively, but he hadn't. The reporters were tiny helicopters carrying microphones and cameras and loudspeakers. Some of them had the ability to project a hologram of a human figure which lip-synced along with the questions from the speaker. "They'll look quite solid when you've tuned your contacts," Reed assured me. "I'm not sure I want them to," I said. I gathered the team again into a group and we all faced the cameras and mics together. Boris and Jaime, I guessed, must have satiated the requests for basic information about us. Most of the questions I was asked, and it was I who was asked, the local media having appointed me the spokesman of the expedition, felt like the reporters here were just mopping up. "You seemed surprised at the sight of us, Miss Ngwethu," said a spectral youth a few feet away. "Don't you have fetches and moats back in the solar system?" "Of course we do," I said. "But as I'm sure you've heard, we have problems with our electronic communications, thanks to our local versions of the fast folk. In any case, even if we didn't, I doubt if we'd use them for, what do you call it? News gathering? We do make limited use of them for exploring or monitoring dangerous environments and so on. So what do you use for news gathering? Do reporters have to go around in person?" "We don't actually have reporters as such," I said. "I mean, some people run newsletters and pump newsfeed pipes, but nobody has to pay them much attention." "So how?" The reporter paused, baffled. "How does anyone know what's going on?" "Oh, that. Well, everybody in the union can report anything to anybody and attend or listen into any meeting of the social administration and say anything they like about it. Or at it, come to that, unless they start wasting everybody's time and get thrown out." "So your central committee, this solar council, could have hundreds of thousands of people turning up at its meetings and all shouting at once?" "Of course not," I said indignantly. "I suppose in theory, yes, but who would want to? Apart from the Solar Council delegates, that is, and some of them practically have to be pushed. It's all very practical and frankly a bit dull. Local meetings are far more interesting because they have more to do." "Does that apply to your organization, the Cassini Division?" asked the hologram. I thought about this.
No, I said.
Why not?
Fighting is different. Sometimes we need to keep secrets, but not for long. The reporter hesitated for a second, and another seized the opportunity. She had straight blonde hair and looked about 12 years old.
Why have you come here? She asked.
I gave her my best smile. We're very interested in finding out what has happened to the only other human community and in establishing friendly relations with you. And of course, we have a scientific interest in the wormhole, the Mali Mile. She gave me her best I wasn't born yesterday look, rather funny considering her age and mine. Apart from that,
isn't that enough?
Why else would we want to come here?
To impose your system on us, perhaps?
This idea had genuinely not occurred to me. Our intention of wiping out the local fast folk or destroying what Reed had called the templates was secret and sinister enough for me to worry about anyone's guessing it. But not this. I just laughed.
You seem to be doing fine as you are, I said diplomatically.
And you can't have socialism unless most people understand it and want it and are willing to do something to get it. From what I know of New Mars, this is not the case. Yet.
This raised an appreciative laugh all round, and Talgarth stepped forward with his hand raised.
Ladies and gentlemen, he said to the phantom figures and their rotary halos, I'm sure our visitors will have a great deal to tell you all very soon. Meanwhile, I'd like to give them some hospitality and privacy.
We'd been having plenty of both until Talgarth and the other leading citizens and their accompanying swarm of inquisitive remote turned up, but I was not complaining. We said goodbye to Abigail and Andrew and were escorted to the big helicopter. I found myself in a window seat beside Tamara. As the machine lifted off, I waved to Powell and his wife, who waved back. The last thing I saw of them before we turned out of sight was Andrew Powell setting off across his field with a swarm of remotes beside him, heading for the ship. I knew he would have the sense not to go too close to it, but I rather suspected that this was not true of the remotes. I leaned back with a smile, already enjoying the flight. Tamara and I got chatting about life on New Mars and on Earth, laughing at each other's misconceptions and about our pasts. I was gratified and embarrassed by Tamara's awe about mine and encouraged her to talk about her own. She said she'd been an abolitionist.
What's that?
Abigail and Dee had mentioned the abolition, but I hadn't yet followed up what this meant.
We used to be a small group of anarchists, some social, some more into the lifestyle thing, who believed that using conscious machines as tools was wrong, you know, like slavery. But 5 years ago, all that changed.
You don't believe it anymore?
Tamara looked at me, visibly decided I was joking, and laughed more at the oddity of my supposed humor than at its content.
No, we changed people's minds. It all came out of a complicated string of court cases involving Wild, the copy of Wild and the Machine, Dave Reed's ownership of Dee, and of course, the Fast Folk. After that, a lot of owned sapients took to claiming self-ownership, and some people sided with them, and the new people from the dead couldn't see how anybody could treat robots like that. They didn't have the prejudices that the first humans here had.
Yes, I said. Wild told us about that. He said things were getting pretty hot just as he left.
They sure were. Closest we've ever come to a revolution. Everybody outside in the streets arguing.
What happened about the Fast Folk? I asked lightly.
Tamara's expression darkened.
Well, after Reed and Wild used them to start the resurrection.
It's still going on. We're bringing back dead people from the smart matter storage all the time.
About 1 million over the past 5 years, which is why the city's grown so much and all the new settlements are springing up. They wiped out the copies of the Fast Folk they'd revived, and Reed's still sitting on the stored originals, still scared of another bad singularity. She paused thoughtfully. But now that your Jovians have started acting reasonable and aren't going mad or anything, maybe that'll change too.
I'm sure it will, I said. Reed won't be worrying about a bad singularity for much longer. Not if I have anything to do with it.
Tamara's pleased look in response to this true but ambiguous statement shamed me a little. I turned to the window and looked down at the city below and before us. 3 of its 5 arms foreshortened, their long streets with their radial canals joined by the ring canal, a glowing starfish in the night. 9. A Modern Utopia. Airports are quiet places where people make their leisurely way along covered walkways to the waiting craft. Around the sides of the concourse are tables with drinks and snacks, open-sided rooms with stores of the kind of supplies you might need and are likely to forget. Racks and shelves where you can browse and, if you like, take away a book or journal or disc. There's a knack, a politesse of picking just enough entertainment for you to have finished at the end of your journey or at the end of one of its stages so that you can casually place it on another airport's shelves. At some airports, there'll be a group of musicians or a troupe of acrobats or whatever. You can stay within sight and sound of them or move away. The only barriers you'll encounter are to keep you from wandering into danger. Sometimes you'll help other people with their luggage. Sometimes you'll ask for a hand. If you have a long wait for your flight, you might feel like joining in some of the support activities, making sure that more hurried passengers get their refreshments or books, or help with heavy luggage or small children. That's what airports are like. Not in capitalism, they're not.
When I emerged at the end of a long corridor from the busy landing field into the main concourse of Ship City's aerospace port,
with my comrades beside me and the leading citizens behind them, I was greeted by hundreds of enthusiastic people behind a barrier, a swooping flock of reporters, a dazzle of clashing colors and a blare of sound. Every square yard that wasn't absolutely required for passengers or people waiting for them was occupied by a stall or shop or kiosk, each of which had its own fluorescent rectangle above it, advertising flights or drugs or socks or cosmetics or lingerie or insurance or backups or cabs or hotels. The public address system thumped out urgent-sounding music made all the more unsettling by frequent and equally urgent-sounding interruptions. Meanwhile, other activity, apparently unrelated to our arrival, was going on. The wide passage between us and the welcoming crowd was being traversed from right to left by a succession of small automatic vehicles, slowly hauling laden trailers, and of briskly striding men and women and, this was my first such encounter, what looked like ape men of various species. Among them robots, few of which were remotely humanoid, stalked or skittered. Outside the terminal building at the far end of the landing field, the distant sounds and flares of heavy lifting shook the air and lit the night. None of the humans or hominids or robots hurrying past in front of us spared us more than a curious, if friendly, glance. I hesitated, unsure about how to get across this stream of light but persistent and swift traffic. Talgarth walked past me and strode out into the midst of it and, facing the oncoming flow, held up his hand. This imperious gesture enabled us to get across to just in front of the barriers. Yells and smiles greeted us, hands reached out to touch us. Recorders and babies were held above heads. Talgarth led us past them all, along the barriers and around a corner into a quieter area, from which even the tiny newscopters were turned back. There were padded benches along the walls. Jaime and Boris were sitting there, looking somewhat drained, but talking earnestly to two young women in identical sky-blue jackets and matching skirts. When they saw us approaching, they said their goodbyes to the women, who immediately stood up and assumed strange fixed smiles and rejoined us. Andrea hugged Jaime, and I hugged Boris, and everybody milled about for a few minutes, until Talgarth herded us all together again like a supervisor on a children's outing and led us between a pair of big glass sliding doors to the edge of a flat expanse of tarmac, where a lot of vehicles were parked, one of which awaited us. It was about 25 feet long and 8 feet high, with large windows at the side and a low-slung chassis. A man in a gray uniform, wearing a gray peaked cap, stood outside its open door and gave us another example of that oddly impersonal smile. Talgarth stepped aside and motioned to us to enter the vehicle. Inside there were rows of seats covered with something like leather, a fitted carpet on the floor, and a smell of fresh plastic in the air. I made my way to the rear seat and sat down beside Boris. Talgarth sat in the seat in front of us, and the rest of the crew filled up the adjacent seats. Reed, Dee, and Tamara all got on too. The others who'd been with them stayed behind, waving at us from the curb, looking simultaneously self-important and left out. As the driver closed the door and got behind the steering wheel, I said to Talgarth, "It's neighborly of you to lay this on for us." "The mini coach?" he smiled. "They're standard airport to city transport." "Well, thanks anyway," I said. "Where are we going?" "Reed's booked a hotel floor for you in the same building as his offices," Talgarth explained. "We'll go to his offices first, if that's agreeable, because we'd like a chat with you all privately before we arrange any other social functions."
"Fine," I said. We have a lot to discuss.
The airport was between the proximal ends of two of the city's arms. Behind it lay miles of open, flat ground, some of it apparently water-covered. As I glanced back through the big curved and rounded rear window, pools flashed back reflections of the jet of a rising rocket. As it faded, another flared. There was a lot of heavy lifting going on. Ahead, along a couple of miles of wide, open road, rose the center of the city. The buildings in the two converging arms on either side of us became higher the closer they were to the center, which was dominated by a cluster of tall, slender towers. They were not as tall as the towers of Earth or the trees of the lunar crater domes, but they were more graceful than either, lifting the gaze and catching the breath. Their lower reaches were linked by spiral or otherwise curving ramps, giving the whole complex an appearance like the fine metalwork of a decorative headdress. Among them were other buildings, rounded, polyhedral, and tall glass rectangles like those I'd, only a fortnight ago, watched Terrible Beauty land beside. All the buildings blazed with lights from windows and flood lamps and displays. We stared ahead, entranced.
"It's beautiful," Suze said.
Reed, sitting in front of her, turned around and said over his shoulder, "It is, and it's also a little joke on us. The more delicate towers and the elegant geodesic domes were designed by the fast folk, based on old illustrations of futuristic cities. Just to say to us, look, we can do this better."
"They did too," said Mally.
His chuckle resounded above the electric hum of the bus.
"I remember those old skiffy covers myself. Bloody spiral ramps. Nobody ever got them looking right, but whoever built this did."
The driver, I noticed, wasn't doing very much, and most of the other vehicles on the road seemed to be driverless. The driver was a formality, a gesture towards the notion of some people serving others, being at their beck and call. Another of those capitalist things, like the air stewardesses that Boris had been talking to, and was now telling me about. I listened skeptically. He seemed unduly impressed by their wage-slavish solicitude. "But are they any more friendly and helpful than neighbors helping out with refreshments on a transport?" I asked, my mind going back to how I and Suze had met. Boris shrugged.
"Maybe not," he said grudgingly. "But they do it all the time, and they do it to get what they need to live on, and that makes it all more intense."
"Ha!" I caught his arm and snuggled up beside him.
"That's kinky, that is,"
I murmured in his ear. "You're just an old Shinasov state capitalist at heart. Bet you've been secretly into employer and employee sex games for years."
"I have not," he growled indignantly,
then turned and touched the side of my nose with the tip of his and grinned.
"Couldn't never get anyone to play anyway, but if that's what you want."
"Go employ yourself," I told him, very quietly. No one even in the adjacent seats could have overheard my crudity. But Dee must have had, perhaps not surprisingly, superhuman hearing, because she turned around and looked back at us from the front of the bus with a friendly and wicked smile, as though she knew exactly what we were talking about. I felt my cheeks burn a little and I looked away. The mini coach was now gliding along a street between tall buildings. At the bases of the tall buildings, the pavements were quite wide and quite crowded, even at this late hour in the evening. The traffic was denser here and slower moving, and as we passed, people, and the startling ubiquitous quasi-people, the enhanced apes and re-engineered hominids and the autonomous machines, on the street would turn and stare for a moment and look around them and smile.
"How do they know we're in this bus?" I asked.
Dave Reed, up at the front, snorted.
He gestured at a flat gray screen behind the driver's seat.
"It's because we're... sorry."
It seemed that all he did was to snap his fingers irritably, and the screen suddenly showed a picture of our coach from above and behind. I looked back through the rear window and spotted the pursuing remotes. The others on the bus laughed.
"Don't encourage them,"
Talgarth said, as I faced the screen again and saw the back of my head in a zoomed-in shot which then zoomed disappointedly out. The newscopters were still hovering above us when we stopped at the foot of a tower like a great concrete tree trunk, with tall windows distributed apparently at random close to the center of the city. Talgarth and Reed preceded us out of the coach, gesturing at the remotes as if waving away flies. As I got off, I thanked the driver and said goodbye to him, making eye contact for the first time. He smiled with a slightly startled look, and smiled a bit more when Dee paused on her way out and slipped him a tip. Inside, the building was furnished in fake leather and real wood, and the inevitable potted plants and indoor ivy, with some of the walls left as bare concrete. The vast, deep-carpeted reception area had the polite hush of posh. The lift, which had a gray uniformed attendant to push the buttons, was big enough to take us all, comfortably. It was also fast, its acceleration almost enough to make my knees buckle. Reed escorted us to a room along the corridor from the lift. It was a large anteroom to a small office, whose heavy wooden desk and deep-set window were visible through its open doorway. An oblong arrangement of deep, fake leather armchairs and sofas around a long, low wooden table with glass ashtrays. Subdued ambient light. Black cylindered spotlights picking out wall pictures, plants, and the drinks cabinet. "Sit yourselves down," Reed said. He took off his jacket and slung it over the back of a seat at the top of the table, marking his own territory, then busied himself at the drinks cabinet. Talgarth hung up his hat and coat, pushed back his shirt sleeves, and sat down, unbuttoning his waistcoat. Dee and Tamara waited for us to take our seats and then sat down together. The chair I found myself in, with Boris on my right and Mally on my left, faced one of the large, well-lit framed photographs on the wall. Most of them showed Reed posing with new weapons systems or talking to what I guessed were capitalists and their hired men. The one opposite me showed Reed and Dee standing together on a wide step outside a vast arched doorway with a crowd of people around them. The man standing beside Reed looked just like Jonathan Wilde, and the woman standing beside Dee looked just like Dee, same height, same build, same face. I realized with a start that I was looking at Dee's original and Wilde's copy, the one who had stayed here. The two men wore black coats and trousers and colorful ties, and the woman standing beside Dee was wearing a long, narrow green dress of understated elegance. Dee was wearing a smug smile and a very fancy white satin dress with fitted bodice, jigget sleeves, and a full floor-length skirt, all decorated with beadwork, cutwork, paneling, stitching, lace trimming, and organza fluting.
Not one expensive cheap trick of exuberant, eye-filling excess had been missed.
On her head, she wore a silver tiara from which a waterfall of embroidered tulle cascaded down her back and across the wide, ruffled pool of the skirt's train. The whole saccharine confection seemed to be the costume for some carnival where considerations of visual impact overrode those of taste. I nudged the suit to record it for the next time I wanted to make a big entrance at one of our wilder parties. Reed placed some trays of glasses on the table, then bottles of spirits, beer, tonic, water, plain water, and cola. "Help yourselves," he said, and while we were doing so, he sat down in the seat at the top of the table with a bottle of beer in front of him. When we were all sorted for drinks, he leaned back in his chair and ran his fingers through his long, thick black hair several times in a rather distracted way, then lit a cigarette. He let out a long, smoky sigh. "Well," he said, "nothing like a bit of peace and quiet. This room is about as secure as you can get, and it's also inside a Faraday cage. Chicken wire in the concrete, I understand. Quite effective." He glanced at what looked like a wristwatch and then at me. "So, Ellen, I'm afraid your encrypted television signal won't get beyond the walls." He grinned. "Just letting you know. It's not a problem. Feel free to record anything and report back to your committee or whatever. I'll give you comms facilities and complete privacy afterwards, if you want." I nodded. "Fine." "Good," Reed said. He looked around at us all. "So let's get down to business. If you want to do deals with people here, it would pay you to deal with us first. Talgarth owns a court, which at the moment is accepted by the other courts as a final court, particularly for human-machine interface problems. Dee and I run the biggest protection agency, which, funnily enough, is the one which has taken your contract. Tamara has the ear of a significant part of the city's population, not to mention a capacity to call a general strike at a moment's notice." Tamara smiled and spread her hands. "Not really." "You're too modest," said Reed. "We're not in charge here. We certainly don't see eye to eye. And I'm much less of a city boss than I was before all the formerly dead people started arriving." He smiled wryly.
"But any of us could make or break your chances of getting on well with the people and machines of this city. I'm not saying that as a threat, just a fact."
"I presume you have some similar status back where you come from and aren't..." his eyes crinkled.
Just a bunch of rank-and-file cosmonauts.
We are, in a way, I said. We have no special status, but we do have a mandate to negotiate and take whatever action we think is necessary.
On behalf of 30 billion people? Asked Reed, looking at me through narrowed eyelids and a haze of smoke.
Somewhere an extraction fan started up. I shrugged.
More or less, in that we'll have to answer to them and they voted for the broad outlines of what we're here to do.
And what's that? Reed asked with deliberate casualness. I took a sip of whiskey and water. The taste for it could be acquired, I decided. Mally was fiddling with his pipe, Suze examining her fingernails.
We're here, I said carefully, to make certain that the fast folk on your side of the wormhole are no threat to us, just as we can ensure that those at our end are no threat to you.
Reed and Talgarth leaned forward at the same time, with the same alert, cautious expression.
What do you mean by that? Asked Talgarth.
Wild, I shook my head. The one you called J-Dub. He told us that the whole question of robot rights was bound up with that of reviving the fast folk, and that when he left, the robot rights side of the argument seemed to be winning. Naturally, we were concerned. I have to say I was relieved to hear from Tamara that you are still resisting any suggestion of reviving them. Can you guarantee that the question will remain closed?
What guarantees would you accept? Reed asked.
Nothing short of their destruction, I thought.
What can you offer? I asked.
Reed knew well that I hadn't answered his question, but he didn't press me on it. He leaned forward, elbow on knee, fingers with cigarette at his lips.
How about our continuing conviction that it would be unsafe to tamper with them again?
You've tampered with them once, I said, and the results, as far as you're concerned, have been entirely beneficial. You've been reunited with people you'd lost. You've gained a population that seems to have materially increased your city's prosperity. You got J-Dub through the wormhole, and so on. Now, I don't remember much about capitalism, but some of us do, and I think it's safe to say that at some point, the temptation to let the genie out of the bottle again, get a few more useful answers to intractable problems, and thus give your company some competitive edge, could be hard to resist.
Reed leaned back and looked straight at me.
That's an entirely valid point, he surprised me by saying, then didn't surprise me at all by going on.
However, I think you can rely on my not doing it until it's safe.
He looked over at Talgarth. What was it I offered? To let anyone do it who could provide an isolated space platform ringed with firewalled lasers and deadfall nuclear backups?
Talgarth smiled and nodded.
Hey, said Boris, with that look shown in cartoons by a light bulb going on and blocky capitals spelling idea.
Nevertheless, I interrupted firmly, you then did it with what?
Blue goo instead of heavy weaponry, and you got away with it.
What's to stop you doing that again?
The rights of the fast folk, Reed said, quite seriously.
What rights? I asked. If we'd been discussing a bacterial culture, I couldn't have been more surprised.
Oh, you know, Reed waved his hands about.
The usual, life, liberty, and the happiness of pursuit.
I sat back and laughed.
But seriously, I said, what's to stop you?
Reed crushed out his cigarette and glared at me.
I am serious. It would be wrong to do again what we did 5 years ago. It was wrong at the time, but,
he grimaced, we didn't know any better.
It would be all right to revive the fast folk and be ready to defend ourselves against them.
That's the lasers and nukes scenario,
but not to revive them and then wipe them out as soon as we got from them what we wanted. So you needn't worry about us doing that.
Talgarth nodded agreement. I frowned, trying to figure this out. Dee and Tamara were watching me even more narrowly than the men were.
You offered to do it for me, I said,
for my revenge.
Reed gave me a cold smile.
An offer I knew you would refuse. You're an intelligent woman.
I wondered how he'd have reacted if I'd accepted, but thought it best to drop that uncomfortable question and return to the main point.
You're telling us we can't trust you not to revive them, but we can trust you not to wipe them out if you do.
That's about it, Reed agreed cheerfully. But as I say, we wouldn't revive them without adequate defense, and there's not much chance of that in the foreseeable future.
I could foresee quite a few futures in which Reed's idea of adequate defense might differ from mine, and where in any case he'd have a strong motivation to deceive himself about how much defense he'd need. But I let that pass for now and tried to work around it. According to Wilde, I said slowly, you used to think very differently. You used to think that the fast folk, in fact all AIs and uploads, were flatlines, not really conscious. And now you're saying our whole safety depends on your continuing to believe the opposite. What changed your mind? Reed gave us all a big, stupid, happy smile. Dee, he said. I shook my head and glanced around at the comrades, then at Dee, who was fixing a steady gaze on me. I had the uncomfortable feeling that she knew what I was thinking. I don't quite understand, I said, lying diplomatically. That's quite understandable, said Reed dryly. It's a matter of experience. I found that I couldn't go on thinking of Dee as I used to before she became autonomous. He smiled at Dee. Before she walked out on me. Looking back, I have to say that my, relationship with her before then was a bit sad and sick, but you have to allow for local custom. Gynoid or android mates were a success symbol for rich people. Very capitalist. He smiled with a flicker of embarrassment. Anyway, after all the trials and challenges she put me through, after the resurrection, after I got to know her again, I found it impossible to regard her as anything less than a person. Not a cunning imitation, not a flat line, but a real woman whom I loved, and who loved me. And because I had frequently, notoriously, and publicly denied that she or any other artificial people were real people, I had no choice but to acknowledge the error of my ways in a very public and decisive manner. He glanced up at the big photograph opposite me, and then smiled at Dee again. I married her. So that was the occasion. Marriage meant a public declaration of a sort of mutual possession, an odd ancient custom, rare in the Union but apparently widespread here. And Reed had made that commitment to this machine in a pretty body and a pretty dress after owning her and using her for years. I hoped my face showed no trace of my revulsion. Ellen, said Dee, it really doesn't matter what you think about us, about me. She stood up and walked around the table and sat herself down on the edge of it, just in front of me. I couldn't avoid her green-eyed gaze. I know you think I'm a machine. Just a fucking machine, yes. But I know I'm human, and if you were to know me for any length of time, you'd find you couldn't treat me in any other way. You can't own me. You can't use me. You can't switch me on and off. You can try, and if you had the power to force me, you could get some use out of me. But you wouldn't get much, and you wouldn't get me. If you want to get all that can be got out of this machine with all its capacities, you have to let me decide to use those capacities. If I'm a machine, Ellen, I'm one that can't function properly unless it's free. She reached forward and touched my face. I didn't flinch. And so are you. So let's just try to be nice to each other, shall we? She stood again and walked back to her chair and sat down beside Tamara. I looked sideways at Suze, who was looking at Dee, at Young, who was looking at the floor.
I reckon, said Mally, that somebody just passed the Turing test.
There was a moment of laughter, tension released. Reed reached over and caught Dee's hand. She passed it long ago, he said. Dee smiled at him and then at me. The warmth of her smile chilled me as much as the passion and cogency of her reasoning had, and the gentle touch of her soft fingertips. It was like one of those uncanny moments when you're looking at what you think is a twig or a leaf, and suddenly it spreads wings and flies away. All right, I said to Reed. I accept that your views about machine consciousness aren't likely to change. Young was still examining the floor. Suddenly her head jerked up.
So what? She said fiercely. You can all believe that if you like. The denial of machine sentience is not part of the true knowledge. It's just an opinion the finders had.
Her hand mimed her search for a word just out of reach. Obiter dictum, suggested Talgarth, gravely. I doubted that Young had heard the phrase before, but she nodded briskly.
Yes, something like that. All the things Dee said, they're part of the true knowledge. It's just the same with people. If we want to make the most of our lives, we have to get the most out of each other, and that means not treating people as less than what they are.
She paused and frowned as though puzzling something out. I felt for her. The cognitive dissonance of being taken in by Dee's startling mimicry must have been painful.
Unless we get more by doing that, of course, which doesn't happen very often. If we meet machines that the same applies to, we can live with it.
She laughed without humor.
We might have to. None of this changes the other problem, of how we deal with machines far more powerful than us. Which, or who, for all I care, could be more than people. We can't live with beings to whom we are like ants.
And we were in their sight as grasshoppers, Reed said, apparently quoting some obscure text. Why do you think we can't coexist?
Because they'd have power over us, Young said, explaining the obvious.
Having more power than us, Reed said with equally heavy patience, doesn't mean the same as having power over us.
All right, said Young, but they'd have it, and they could always use it, just like you did to the fast folk you revived.
Ah, said Reed. They. That's interesting. I understand you're negotiating with these Jovians. How are you doing it?
I glanced around the team. No one flashed any warning looks, so I explained how the contact had been made and how the communications were being carried on.
So, said Reed when I'd finished, how many of them are there?
I shrugged. Millions, possibly.
Thousands, at least. And they're some kind of hive mind, right? Some gigantic collective entity?
No, I told him, not sure what he was getting at.
They say they're individuals, and all the evidence we have indicates that's what they are.
Some kind of totalitarianism, then? Each subordinate to a single will, as Lenin put it? Or some angelic anarchy where they all agree on the obvious common good?
Of course not, I said impatiently. We've noticed signs of disagreement among them, and they take time out for discussion and then come back to us.
Reed shared a grin with Talgarth. He smacked his palm with his fist.
Ha! He exulted. Knew it.
Knew what? I asked.
That you people would be negotiating with the Jovians as if they were a hive entity, and as if you were, come to that.
He chuckled darkly.
And you've made the same mistake with us, he added. When I said we weren't in charge here, I meant it. While we've been talking, quite a few enterprising people have been acting. People who have been thinking ahead, designing ahead, planning ahead, during the 5 years it's taken for a confirmation to come back through the gate that it was safe to go through. And now it has. Now you're here. They've been scrambling to get ships in orbit, ready to go through themselves. Bit of a jostle to be first, but I'm sure the protection agencies are keeping order in the queue of ships that must be building up right now outside the wormhole.
He took a swig of his beer and lit a cigarette, blatantly enjoying our startled looks and Tamara's smoldering outrage. This was apparently news to her, too.
To do what? I asked, shouting above the rest.
Reed leaned back and clasped his hands and made cracking noises with his knuckles.
To trade, he said. What else?
I laughed. They won't get much profit out of trading with us, I said. And anyway, they don't know the way through.
Indeed they don't, Reed said.
But I do. I got it from the fast folk, remember? Just as I got the path for going the other way. And I'm going to sell it. He affected a glance at a wristwatch. Any time now, the bids should be coming through. Tony leaned forward.
Very clever, he said. But quite frankly, they'll be wasting their money. The businesses you're about to sell this secret to aren't going to be too happy when they find out we don't need anything you've got to offer, and nothing on our side is for sale at any price. Either because we'll share it for free, or we won't give it to you for anything. Like Ellen said, not much profit in that.
He took this as his turn to sit back and look smug.
I wouldn't be too sure of that, Reed said. He waved his hand airily. Not that it matters. Most of the companies I'm talking about aren't that interested in trading with people in the Solar Union, anyway.
So who?
I stopped, unwilling to accept the obvious answer.
Oh no, you're not.
We are, Reed said calmly. We're going to trade with the Jovians.
For a moment, we were all stunned into silence. It was Young who spoke first, her normally high voice raw with anger and concern.
This is insane, she said. Just look at yourselves. I've seen how comms work here.
You have radio for everything, electronic computers everywhere, including your bodies, and lots of you have cortical downlinks, direct electronic interfaces with your brains, right? You're just ridiculously vulnerable, absolutely naked to viral assault and takeover. You're a culture medium for the things. The Jovians could eat your minds alive and you'd never know.
We've considered that, Reed said calmly. We're confident that our countermeasures will hold them off.